From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. 3 years into the worst economic recession in almost a century, people are wondering about the American dream, wondering if it's still possible to get ahead, wondering if the next generation will have a better life than the one before. But if you look at history, a shaky economy hasn't diminished people's faith in the American dream. The term was conceived during the Great Depression, and people have always believed no matter how bad things got, the values of the country will provide a way out. It's a dream embedded in our mythology and our politics. NPR has just started a series about the American dream, and it's giving us a chance to explore the idea. We'll talk about where it came from, what it means, and how it's playing out in the 21st century. We hope you'll join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you hear the term the American dream, you know what it means, more or less. It's the idea that if you play by the rules, you'll get ahead, that the next generation will always have a better life than the one before. 3 years now into the worst economic recession in almost a century, where the economy is still shaky, the gap between the rich and poor is wider than ever, some are starting to wonder if it makes sense to believe in this dream. But what does it mean, really? If you look at the country's history, bad economic times haven't really diminished people's faith in this dream. After all, the term was conceived during the Great Depression. The fact is, the dream is plastic, and it takes on different meanings for different people at different times. Still, it's deeply embedded in our culture and our consciousness. NPR has just started a series about the American dream, and it's giving us a chance to explore the idea and ask how it's playing out in the 21st century. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and Twitter. Joining us is Ari Shapiro. He reports on the White House for NPR, focuses on national security and legal affairs. He's joining us today from the White House. And Ari Shapiro, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
John Itzde is with us. He has covered the economy, Wall Street, and the federal budget for NPR for 2 decades now. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. And John, welcome to you.
Nice to be with you, Doug.
Ari Shapiro, I wanted to start with you because you've been thinking about this idea for a long time now, and I wanted you to begin by talking about how you got started. As I understand it, this was a roundtable discussion that you were participating in, and you got to thinking about all of this.
Yeah, it was Senator Charles Schumer, a Democrat of New York, who had this roundtable conversation over breakfast with a bunch of reporters. This was almost a year ago, maybe more. And over the course of this wide-ranging conversation, he mentioned almost in passing that the average worker today makes about 10% less than that same worker made a decade ago. And Schumer said this has profound implications for the American dream and for the faith that we as Americans have that the next generation will have a better life than the previous generation. And so that sort of started the gears turning in my head. And then as I was thinking about this, I tuned into people talking about the American dream in my news coverage and my consumption of culture and music and movies and on the campaign trail. And I realized that this idea in various forms is everywhere, and that this moment we're in right now feels like kind of a crucial, precarious point for the American dream.
The sense that it could possibly go away in some way or just kind of transform into something else.
Well, either. I mean, you can look at it both ways. You know, pollsters ask Americans whether they believe that success is within their own hands or beyond their control. And the percentage of people who say it's beyond your control is still a minority, but has grown by about 20% in the last few decades. So that suggests the American dream could be shrinking or dying. But there are other pollsters. John Zogby, for example, has been asking about the American dream for many decades, and he sees a transformation of the American dream into something new so that, in his view, it's no longer so much about material wealth and things like owning a house, but it's more about spiritual fulfillment and the sense that what you're doing is valuable and makes a difference and matters in the world and you have some greater purpose in life. So I don't think it's a question of is it transforming or is it diminishing. I think there are aspects of both in looking at this right now.
It's interesting, the concept you've written about this, that the concept itself, at least the bigger idea, has been around as long as the country has been, but the term isn't really all that old.
Yeah, I was shocked to learn that the term really had its origins in the Great Depression. You know, we think that one reason the American dream is so precarious right now is because of the bad economic conditions that we're in. But the fact is, when economic conditions were far, far worse in the early 1930s, the American dream really had its roots in a book by a historian that had the working title, The American Dream. The ultimate title of the book ended up being The Epic of America. But historians trace that as the moment that this idea really came into full flower. Of course, the underlying ideas, as you mentioned, stretch all the way back to the country's founding, this sense of optimism and growth and potential. But the American Dream as a specific concept kind of had full flower when the country was economically at its worst.
Mm-hmm. What are you learning about how it plays out in culture? Because it's a you've mentioned, for example, you quoted The Great Gatsby in one of your pieces as this idea that it's kind of a motif for who we are in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I think in the 20th century, a lot of the manifestations of the American dream in culture were about the dream becoming more accessible to people to whom it was not accessible before.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, the civil rights movement and racial minorities having rights that they previously didn't have, the women's liberation movement. In a lot of the 20th century, you saw cultural expressions of the American dream being about growth by groups that had previously been marginalized into the full flower of what had previously been available only to small numbers of people. But you also see a pretty consistent thread of skepticism and critique of the American dream. If you look at a play like Death of a Salesman, yeah, or one cut of tape that I was not able to get on the air but I just love was the trailer for the movie Scarface starring Al Pacino as this sort of drug-dealing monster. The trailer says he loved the American dream, and then you hear machine gun fire and it says, with a vengeance.
So it's always been with us, really, this idea, right?
It's always been with us, and it's always been changing, whether we're talking about growing the dream or critiquing the dream or shifting the meaning of the dream. This underlying idea has been there, but it's never meant exactly the same thing to the same people in the same era.
John, today I want to bring you into this part of the conversation. What are you learning about the way Americans are thinking about the American dream in terms of the sense of whether it exists or how much fair, because we'll talk about economic inequality as we go. But what are you learning about the way Americans are, as you're talking to people, the way people are thinking about it, talking about it?
Well, I think generally Americans still believe in this dream that each generation will do better than the last and that it's easier to move up the economic ladder. You know, it took a bit of a hit during the recession, and I think it will take some time for it to regain full strength, but it's still there. And certainly this notion of economic mobility and doing better is a bedrock of the American dream. After all, America was sort of founded, I guess, in 1607 when Jamestown was founded, and that was an economic enterprise. And that's been a thread throughout American history, that people come here to do better economically, as well as for religious freedom and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what I also found is that there are parts of the American dream that aren't quite that are sort of based on myth and that fall short of reality. And the notion that Americans are more mobile, that is, they can climb the rungs of the income ladder, go from being poor to being rich, go from being middle class to being upper class. We think that that's kind of a uniquely American thing and that it's easier to do here than anywhere else in the world. And that's simply not true. There are Canada and a number of European nations, developed nations, have higher income mobility than we do.
So it's in, I mean, you talked to Aaron Currier with the Pew Charitable Trusts, John, in one of your stories, who talked about this impression that we sort of create for ourselves as a country, that, you know, each generation moves up on this ladder. And it seems like there's a lot of myths in this story of the American dream. Did you find that?
Well, you know, yeah, myths aren't necessarily always untrue.
Right.
And there's an element of truth, and sometimes there are more truth than the facts are. But, you know, there is truth that Americans do better. Each generation does better than the last. And you have to sort of divide this into two pieces. There's something called absolute mobility, and there's something called relative mobility. And the absolute mobility is this notion that it's sort of like an escalator. As the economy grows people get wealthier in general, people move up the ladder. So that right now you can say that about two-thirds of Americans are doing better than their parents did. Now, they're not may not be doing better much, and it might be mostly because the broad economy is growing, but they are doing better. So each generation doing better than the last. That is still true in America, very true in America. But this other notion of relative mobility, mm-hmm. that is moving from the lower class to the middle class or moving from the middle class to the upper class, that is, that is not as true as we think it is. Yeah. And as I said, many other countries are more mobile in that regard than we are. And one of the problems is that the rungs on that ladder are getting further and further apart. So it's harder to get from the lower rung up to the middle and to the top.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about some of the people actually that you've been talking to and you've been profiling in the stories you're producing. John, I wanted to ask you about Kevin Hill. He's a landscaper in San Diego that you write about. Grew up in this middle-class family, developed a kind of thriving landscaping business, and then the housing bubble bursts and things fall apart. He loses his house. Now, Kevin's African-American, and you write about how the statistics regarding this, you know, American dream for this segment of the population are kind of troubling, kind of disturbing.
Yeah, this is one of the most troubling statistics that I found in my reporting, and that is that African-American men who are born into the middle class, 40% of them slide out of the middle class back into one of the lower percentiles in their generation. And it's partly because, you know, minorities and African Americans in particular have so few assets that when something goes wrong, for instance, Kevin lost his house. He was foreclosed on. And, you know, in a lot of cases in middle and upper middle class families, a parent might be able to step in and help their son or daughter keep their home. But in Kevin's case, his family just didn't have those assets. They didn't have those savings. And he slid back down. So I think, you know, it was a very troubling thing. The other thing about Kevin that was interesting and he represented in a way is he chose not to get a college education. Both his parents, interestingly, in fact, he said a grandmother, I believe, got a college education, something very rare for African Americans back in the early 1900s when she would have been in college. And he chose not to. He's a bit of a free spirit, and he decided he wanted to he actually took some accounting courses. He got some work at a bank, didn't like the corporate world, decided he wanted to follow his real love of plants and do something with that. He got a cart going up in Boston, in Harvard Square it was, and sold flowers out of that. And he finally moved to the West Coast and developed this landscaping business, became very successful, was making a good living, had a crew that was working for him. He had a retail store at one point. But in the end, you know, when the housing bubble burst, he found himself without a house, without clients. His parents couldn't help him, and now he's, you know, a 44-year-old man without a college education who's trying to find work.
Mm. Here's a moment from John's story. This is Kevin Hill.
I'm still just kind of, I don't have control of my life because the opportunities aren't there, you know. How do you dream when there's no opportunity for you to dream?
Ari Shapiro, I wanted to have you follow up on that, this idea. What does it do to you, the sort of the American psyche? I mean, this idea, you know, Kevin's talking about being lost, having no control. Are you finding a lot of that, it really gets in there?
This is one thing that I've asked a lot of people that I've interviewed and had a hard time getting a really clear answer to, is on a big scale, if the American dream disappears, if our country is no longer defined by this idea that hard work pays off and the next generation will be better off than the next generation, then what? Yeah. You know, what difference does it make? Why is the American dream important? And some people have said, well, then I think, you know, America loses its special place in the world and stops being sort of the preeminent country that everyone looks to. To which I respond, if America is eclipsed in the world, it will presumably be eclipsed by a country like China, which has no American dream, in which this idea does not apply. And so why is it that the American dream is so vital to – I mean, I understand that it's vital to the American identity.
Yeah.
And that if it disappears, the American identity becomes something different. But is it vital to American supremacy and to American preeminence? I think maybe on the kind of mythic level that John was talking about just a moment ago. But I'm not sure on the economic level.
You know, Ari, if I may interrupt, this is an interesting thing. When I talked to a couple from Minneapolis, Pam Crank and Brian McGee, about the American dream, I asked him what it meant to him. And he said, well, you know, it's about my children doing better than I did, them having opportunities to move up beyond where or the ones that I've had. And he said, but I can't say that's an American dream. He said, I believe most people in the world want that for their children. And so we you know, sometimes we, I think, label it the American dream. But it's, I think, really shared pretty worldwide. We claim it as we claim America as a place where it happens, and it doesn't. You know, we believe it doesn't always happen in other places. But I think most people want that kind of thing for their children.
I wanted to ask about because I'm sure you're going to be exploring how this is playing out in politics. It's become, of course, a popular theme in politics. And it's interesting how everyone invokes the American dream. I mean, even Mitt Romney's, he had a pretty, you know, privileged background. He's able to invoke the idea, this idea of only in America. How are you seeing it, Ari, play out in the political campaign season?
Well, one person who I interviewed described the presidency as the high priest of American politics who has to embody this idea of the American dream. And so in Barack Obama's case, it's being raised by a grandmother, an absent father, you know, somebody who, as he said during his inauguration speech, whose father 60 years ago would have had a hard time being served a meal in Washington, D.C., his son can now take the sacred oath of office. In Mitt Romney's case, he talks about how his father grew up poor, sold paint out of the back of his car in Michigan, and grew up to be the governor of that state of Michigan. So whoever's running for president has to embody this idea. But they also both talk about the precariousness of the American dream today and how to get it back. And that's just as far as the agreement goes, that it's precarious and you have to get it back. Beyond that, Mitt Romney says we need to raise the ceiling on successful people to give people more motivation to succeed, and we need to lower the floor on people in terms of the safety net that the government offers them, social welfare programs, because otherwise, again, they'll have little incentive to succeed if they know that they have a cushy landing provided for them by the government. Barack Obama takes the exact opposite position. He says the way to make the American dream attainable is to lower the ceiling on the wealthy and get them to pay a little bit more in taxes in order to fund things like college loan subsidies so that the people who are at the bottom end of the spectrum can have a little more of a boost to get back up to the level that they need to be at in order to achieve the American dream.
Let me ask you, both of you, finally, so where's the series headed now? What are the other things you're trying to explore, and what are the things you're trying to learn as you go?
Well, we have aspects of the American dream that are going to be viewed from the foreign desk. Some of our reporters overseas are looking at what it means for immigrants. Some of our cultural desk, our arts desk reporters are looking at how the American dream has been expressed over time through movies, through music. We have first-person artist sort of narrative and testimonials about what the American dream means to them and how it's translated into their work. We're going to have other sort of stories from around the country from our national desk. You know, we just had something this week, yesterday, in fact, on what the American dream means in terms of housing and where that stands in the wake of the housing crisis and lots of other threads that we're going to be pursuing throughout the summer.
John, any surprise? Are you finding any surprises as you're working through all of this?
You know, I would say the most surprising things have to do with, for instance, slipping back down into the bottom for African Americans who are born into the middle class. The other thing that I think is interesting is, you know, Pew did a study that looked at how much the government spends on what they would call mobility-enhancing kinds of things, education and that sort of thing, housing, etc. And what they found was that the government spends a huge amount of money on it, something like $750 billion annually. But the issue is that almost three-quarters of that goes to the upper and middle – or upper – middle and upper class, and only about 25% of it goes to the bottom. So that you have people who are already doing well, being helped to do even better, but people at the bottom are still suffering. And I think Stuart Butler, who's someone from the Heritage Foundation, a scholar over there, suggested, you know, that a conservative foundation. But he said, you know, he thinks the American dream is really alive and well for folks at the top and in the middle. But he's really worried about the bottom. And, you know, it's very difficult. If you're born into the bottom, 40% likelihood that you're going to stay there. And not be able to, you know, attain the American dream.
It's John Itzde, Ari Shapiro also with us from NPR. Guys, thanks very much for the time.
Great talking
Welcome,
with you.
Welcome, Doug.
We have links to Ari and John's stories about the American dream and others, by the way, on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the American dream. You hear the term all the time, and you know what it means. It's this idea that if you play by the rules, you'll get ahead. But we're a few years into the Great Recession, where the economy is still shaky, and the gap between the rich and poor is wider than ever, and our perspective is changing. John Kenneth White is joining us. He's a professor of politics at the Catholic University of America. He's the co-editor of the book, The American Dream in the 21st Century, joining us from his home in Gaithersburg, Maryland. And John Kenneth White, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess we should start. I wanted to begin with the idea of the term itself, the American dream. The concept, as we've been talking about on the show, is as old as the country is. But what... Talk a bit, if you would, about the term itself, where it originated and what we were thinking about at the time.
Sure. There was a historian named James Adams who was writing a long history of the United States, and his book, which is still available, is called The Epic of America. But in the book itself, several times and throughout, Adams coined the term American dream to describe these threads of our history that kind of wove us together. And the first edition of The Epic of America was published in 1931. It was actually supposed to be called The American Dream. That was Adams's title for his own book, and his publisher said, no, that won't work. Try this. And actually, it turned out, of course, Adams was quite right. And the term American Dream really stuck in our lexicon after that, and so we so frequently use the term today, and Americans have a very good idea of what's meant, even though, as your guest said before, our concepts of those ideas have changed over time.
You can find the concept in the, as you write, in the country's founding documents, like the Declaration of Independence, this idea of being endowed by a creator with certain, you know, particular rights. This is the American dream? Is that the one concept of it, that we're
that
entitled?
Certainly is an important part of it. I think there are three really core values to the American dream. One is freedom. One is individual rights. And the other is equality of opportunity. And if you were to rank order them, while they're all important, really equality is the most important of all, because equality of opportunity is a state of mind. And while you can take away individual rights and you can take away freedom, if you and I think of each other as being equal, and even if we think of each other as being born equal, that's a concept that you can never take away.
I wanted to ask you about, we'll get to politics as we go here, but it's also, you mentioned how this idea of the American dream is expressed in popular culture. It's given it a powerful voice. Ari was mentioning that Scarface trailer,
right.
Something you write about as well. There's also more conventional ideas too. Moss Hart and others talk about it. How do we see it expressing itself in the culture?
You know, there's a great line in a Bruce Springsteen song called "The River," which is, is the American dream real, or does it represent something worse? We've never really wanted to consider the something worse, that it's an illusion. And we're always looking in the popular culture for stories, whether it's Moss Hart or Barack Obama or anybody else, because we want to derive moral lessons from those stories. It's not just that they're interesting stories, but that they're stories of people who have achieved a degree of success from which we can say, I can do that too. And so... it's not just in politics, as I said. It's true. It really is deeply, deeply embedded in our popular culture. Mm-hmm. No question about it. And there's just so many films, by the way, where you see this level of success that the actors achieve. There's one in which Will Smith and his son play a parent and a child who are homeless,
yeah.
And they meet the right people, and they ultimately achieve a degree of success, and they wind up being happy, but not just happy economically, but happy as a family. That's sort of another example of the American dream again coming to life and being made semi-real.
It's interesting you write about the fact that most Americans don't want to consider that there is no such thing as an American dream. We'll rework it, I guess. It's pretty malleable, the concept.
Right.
We'll find a way to believe in it in some way?
Well, you know, that idea goes back actually to the 1960s. There was a political scientist by the name of Robert Lane who wrote a book called Political Ideology. And what he did was he actually just went out and interviewed ordinary Americans in New Haven, Connecticut. He was on the Yale faculty at the time. And what he found was people who had not achieved the American dream, but they were completely unwilling to say that it was the fault of the country or it was the fault of the ideology or to say even that the American dream was an illusion. Instead, they blamed themselves. It's my fault. Mm. I made bad choices. I could have made better choices. If I had made better choices, I would have succeeded in life. But it is what it is, and I am where I am. And that is really stuck, I think, for a very long period of time. The question is there a willingness on the part of the public now, or a greater segment of the public, as your previous guest noted, to say, well, wait, I think the American dream isn't working, and I'm not sure if it can work. I think that's relatively new in our history to some extent.
Mm.
The only other time in recent history where we began to question the American dream was back in 1979 when Jimmy Carter gave his Malay speech.
Yeah.
And what happened, we have another great polling question, which is, put yourself on a ladder scale. Put where you were 5 years ago. We mark that spot. Where are you today, which has always been a little bit higher? Where do you expect to be 5 years from now? And that ladder of opinion, as it was called, was always moving upward. In 1979, that top end of the ladder moved down, and that caused the alarm bells to ring in the Carter White House, and ultimately Carter's pollster advised him to give the so-called malaise speech.
Yeah.
Bad advice, I think, as it turned out, and Ronald Reagan's pollster said, look, this is really going to help us win the White House, because essentially Carter is saying, it's not my fault, Americans, it's your fault. And blaming the voters is never a good political strategy.
And it seems like the candidates for office, certainly for president, have learned that lesson since. It's become now a regular theme, I guess, of presidential
races. Absolutely, because Americans just don't want to know the policies of a particular candidate. Well, yes, of course, we want to know what they're going to do as president, naturally. But the vote for president is a very personal vote, and we really want to know their story, not just because it's a great story or it's interesting or it's entertaining, but because, again, there are moral lessons from which you can derive from that story. So it is true, I have written that that we expect the American president to be the high priest of American politics and to give voice to the American dream. Because, again, we take so many lessons from it. And just to give you a few quick examples, when Richard Nixon ran for president in 1960, in his acceptance speech, he said, I believe in the American dream because I've seen it come true in my own life. Bill Clinton in 1992 was the man from Hope, Arkansas. Again, I believe in a place called Hope. Here I stand before you, a man of poor background and poor means, as the nominee of my party for the presidency. Mike Dukakis, it's a great story about him because he emphasized when he ran for president his Greek heritage. He had never done this running for governor of Massachusetts, and it's a great joke at the time. Some people would say, I knew Mike Dukakis before he was Greek. So we sort of know what that means. And of course, with Obama and Romney, again, both of them are essentially telling stories about themselves and their own background. And one of the, I think, important aspects about Obama is that he has exercised a lot of control over the telling of his own story, by and large. Because, again, he understands that the importance is not the story in of itself, but that the lessons that the listener is going to be able to derive from it. And so his book, The Audacity of Hope, has as its subtitle The Reclaiming of the American Dream.
Mm. Do you hear that a lot, this idea of let's get it back, that it went away for a time, we'll reinvent it, we'll refind it? It's Morning in America again is a good example of that, I suppose.
Yeah, we're always, I think we always worry about the American dream. We'll never stop worrying about it. Do we have it? Can we get it? How quickly can we get it? And once we got it, did we get all of it?
Yeah.
I think there's always that restlessness in American society. I think there's more worry now, largely, again, because of our economic situation that we're in, and a sense that the world about us is changing so rapidly. I think that worry is pretty deep because the term American dream is such a great shorthand for expressing what we believe in and what values animate us as a country.
John Kenneth White is with us. He's a professor of politics at the Catholic University of America, the co-editor of the book, The American Dream in the 21st Century. And We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the idea, the concept of the American dream. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We have with us John Kenneth White, professor of politics at the Catholic University of America. He's been writing about, thinking about the American dream. We invite you to join the conversation with your perspective. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Zach is with us in Springville. Zach, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
So it seems to me that the American dream expresses this contradiction, you know, pull yourself out by your bootstraps, but be given the opportunity to do so, and that we're always negotiating that contradiction. And, like, I grew up in Canada, and the American dream feels alive and well in Canada, and like you said, in these other countries, because I wonder, do you think that our need to define it and constantly reevaluate it and try and live by it and live within this contradiction and try and negotiate it leaves us with a certain neurosis that makes it, like, harder to engage in, where other people sort of, they can just appropriate it and engage within it without that neuroses, without that sort of baggage. So it almost seems like that need to define it makes it harder for us to achieve it.
Yeah. The stakes aren't quite as high maybe in another place that doesn't have a so-called American dream.
Yeah, or they are perfectly willing to appropriate the American dream for themselves and live it, but they don't feel the need to try and define it.
Yeah, yeah. John Kenneth White, what do you think?
There was a great line by the late political scientist Seymour Martin Lipset. He said that Canada is a lovely place, but America is an idea. And so the sense of becoming American doesn't mean that you inhabit the soil. You're not an American simply because you live in Salt Lake City. It's because you subscribe to these ideals. And so we place this enormous priority on this kind of universal subscription, if you will, to freedom, individual rights, equality of opportunity. And because the American dream is so bound up in it, there is, I guess, a kind of perhaps neurosis or obsession, or call it what you will, about the American dream that perhaps doesn't exist elsewhere to the same degree.
Yeah. Zach, we're glad you called. Thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Well, this idea then, just how unique it is as an American concept. I wanted to play a clip. This is something we didn't get to when we were talking to Ari Shapiro earlier. It comes from a story that he had produced, a conversation he had with Michael Dimmock of the Pew Research Center, talking about the idea that the American dream is in some ways uniquely American. Here he is, Michael Dimmock.
When you look at European countries, when Germans or French are asked the same questions about whether it's within all of our power to get ahead or whether our success is really determined by forces outside our control, most say, no, success is really beyond our control.
What do you think? This idea that the American dream means that you have control of your destiny.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. And we have a ream of polling data that goes back over decades that basically poses this question to Americans. Is it hard work that guarantees success, or is it really luck? And Americans almost universally will say it's hard work. Hard work will guarantee success, and therefore your destiny is within your own hands. And because that's so firmly believed, if we don't achieve the American dream, then we're not willing to blame the president necessarily, or say the country's ideas are an illusion. Rather, we're much more willing to blame ourselves. I failed. It's not that someone else failed.
Mm. Talk about
there's
this.
A great, just one last thing on this. In the 1980s, when Reagan was president, Dan Rather went to Iowa and talked a lot about the Reagan recession, and talked to an Iowa farmer who farm was about to foreclose. And the farmer basically said, it's my fault. I'm not sure that's the answer Rather was expecting. I think he was actually expecting a critique of the president. Hmm. But I think the answer he got was reflected a reality that still exists.
Let's go back to the phones. Jason is joining us in Salt Lake. Jason, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
I'd like to hear a little bit about the societal notion of absolute inclusion and how it relates to the American dream, specifically the ideals of like everyone should own a home, or every child should go to college, or every person should have a job. I just from my own experience, I know that having these ideals out there, which are, I think, are great principles to strive towards, but I think they put an unrealistic, almost absurd expectation on our society. Not everyone should go to college, or not everyone can go to college or own a home. And I think that relates and strikes to the core, for me at least, of the American dream. And I'd be more than happy to take my response off the air. And thank you very much.
Jason, thanks. Yeah, to the expectations that we have.
Right. And those expectations have changed over time. I think if you go back and you look at the 1980s, for example, we see a lot of emphasis on materialism. It's having the good job, owning the home, going from the janitor of the company to the CEO of the company. What we've got now is a more spiritual side to the American dream, where people are saying, well, look, part of the American dream means that I have a job that allows me personal self-fulfillment, where I am at an equal relationship with my so-called boss, where we're partners rather than simply an employer-employee type of relationship. A job that will allow me to spend more time with my family, for example, that will allow me some flexibility. I'm using the term spiritual loosely, but particularly after 9/11, we saw this shift in the American dream, and we're constantly, I think, redefining it. So it's not simply a static notion that's rooted largely in economic success. That's the most tangible manifestation of it, but we see this increasing spiritual side to it, which has become much more important.
Well, this is something that John Zogby writes about in your book, and I wanted to explore that a little bit more, because he talks about this idea. He sort of breaks it down into four particular groups, and you have the group that says it believes in the American dream, and they define it as material success. That's what that's what that means. And then you have another group that says, "I believe you can achieve the American dream, but it doesn't mean money or a boat. It means spiritual fulfillment."
Right.
And it used to be that there are other groups, and I'll talk about those in a moment, but those were the main ones, the groups who saw it as material success and those who saw it as spiritual fulfillment. And it used to be that the materialists, the people who saw it as material success, who were represented most of America. But these days, and I'm not sure when the transformation was, more people see the American dream in spiritual terms.
Right. And he has argued that transformation coincided at least with 9/11 and seems to have lived on well past it. And I think there's a lot to that, because one of the things that Zogby has done in other writing, and I think it's very important, is if you look at companies, for example, that have achieved a certain level of success, they've incorporated that spiritual element in their relationships with their employees to give more flex time, for example, to allow more employee input in the direction of the company, and so on. And so I think we're finding that successful enterprises in this country are not just simply focused on the material side, that to attract good people and good workers and to be successful, ultimately they need to incorporate those values.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Jason, thanks very much. Let's go back to the phones. Chris is with us in Mapleton, Utah. Chris, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier in the show, you talked about, accountability and that idea back when, you know, people were polled and asked, you know, is the American dream still alive? And, you know, and if they failed, it's my own fault. And I think that, you know, the idea of accountability, I have a small business, and I'm perfectly willing to take accountability, and I think a lot of other people out there are too. But some of the challenges that are in front of us as small businesses is the government getting in the way of that. It's hard to take accountability when, you know, the simple thing like putting a sign up, a new sign on your store because, you know, business is down, trying to drum up a little more advertising, you know, and to spend, you know, $500 in permits and it takes 6 weeks to get a new sign up. I just think that takes away from that accountability, that willingness to take accountability and say, look, I want to be successful. I'm willing to work to be successful, but government, get out of my way. You know, back 50 years ago, you could just open up a store, put a sign up, and you're in business. And I've heard many business owners, including some very successful ones, say that they would never have been successful if they were trying to start a business today.
John Kenneth White, what do you think about that? It seems like this is how this is playing out in the political landscape.
Right. And that's part of the argument, really, in 2012, is what is the role of government and what should be the role of government to help Americans achieve the American dream to the maximum extent that they can. And certainly Romney's argument, the Republican Party's argument, is, as the caller said, government, get out of the way. Government, you're inhibiting my ability to achieve the American dream. Government, with your regulations, makes the American dream for a small business entrepreneur almost impossible to achieve. And if you eliminate all of that, then success can be yours and the obstacles along life's roadway is removed. Another argument is sort of contrary to that. Say, well, look, first, success is not something that's just individually achieved. There can be this idea of communitarian success, the building up of a nation, of a structure. And we saw that we're kind of at war within ourselves between our emphasis on individual rights and expansion, and yet we also want to build our communities, our roads, our bridges, our education institutions, and so on. And some even would say, and I think Obama would say this, well, look, I also want government to be involved in terms of passing legislation so that children of immigrants who were brought to the United States illegally can achieve the American dream, can achieve citizenship, and so forth if they take certain steps, the so-called DREAM Act that's been proposed before Congress. So deeply tied into the American dream. And so we have both parties taking pieces of the American dream and basically saying we have very different solutions as to how it ought to be achieved.
You referenced the political commentator E.J. Dionne, who saw Republicans as focusing on the individual, Democrats as focusing on the community. That's
right.
That's the competing vision, I suppose, of what the American dream means.
And I think it gets expressed, too, in this spiritual side of the American dream, this sort of newfound notion in the last decade or so that Zogby points out, that I think Democrats have latched on to, whereas Republicans have held on to this more traditional idea of the American dream, being the janitor of a company and becoming the company's CEO, this idea of individuals achieving unlimited success if only government would get out of the way. That whole idea was really very well articulated by Ronald Reagan.
Let's go back to the phones. Juan is with us in Midvale. Juan, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm calling because I moved here to the United States because I wanted to have more opportunities myself and to provide more opportunities to my kids. So I guess that is probably part of what we outside of the U.S. understand as the American dream, a place where you will have more opportunities. But just listening to the previous phone call, I also was thinking, well, but at the same time, all this prosperity is possible because we here in the U.S., we have all those government institutions that make sure that we all follow the rules. If we want to be in a place where government is out of our back, well, let's go to Somalia. There's no government there, and you can do whatever you want. But the problem is that everybody else can do whatever they want, and that's not a country. That's just a nightmare for their own people. So I guess that the American dream is something that inspires us to move here, and many people want to move into the U.S. But at the same time, once here, we see that, well, this thing works because there's a strong government that makes sure that we all can work and reach that dream. So. Hmm.
Juan, thanks very much. Kenneth White, it's interesting. So this idea can't just be a concept. It has to align with some kind of infrastructure, and I guess the country has it, right?
Yeah, and we're still at war within ourselves, not just individualism versus communitarianism. Here's another great example. If you go back and look at the polling data over the last 50 years or so, Americans are ideologically conservative. They want smaller government. They think government is too big, too intrusive, too large, etc. Then when you say, well, what about this program? Oh, don't cut education. Don't cut that program. Don't cut Social Security. Don't cut Medicare. And the idea is that we're ideologically conservative but operationally liberal. We want government to provide a helping hand. But when does that hand become oppressive? That's always the question we're wrestling with.
John Kenneth White, he is the professor of politics at the Catholic University of America, co-editor of the book The American Dream in the 21st Century. His other co-editor was Sandra L. Hansen. John Kenneth White, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.